Yeah, I have to admit that I really did start laughing on that television show, because not only, as Bob said, this is not the approach that we use for drugs or alcohol, but what about diet? And what about exercise and tanning salons and all these things that we say, you know, eat your fruit and vegetables and don't eat your junk food. And anyway, I know I don't have to convince you. So I'm going to return to the theme that I introduced earlier, which is that as a doctor, my biggest challenge is not dangerous diseases, but dangerous ideas. And another one of these ideas, one of the most radical in this war that we're in, and this is a war, make no doubt about it, one of those ideas concerns maleness and femaleness, and it hinges on the definition of one word, and the word is gender. Most people believe that the word gender is synonymous with the word sex, that it means male or female, and that male or female is determined by, well, anatomy. You know that. A baby is born, you take one look, their gender is known, right? Wrong. That is not correct. Gender is not the same as sex, and in order to fight effectively in this war of ideas, the differences between the two must be understood. Sex is based on anatomy and chromosomes. Gender is defined as a feeling, an internal, subjective experience of being either male or female. I discovered this definition of the word gender when I began to study what we in the United States called comprehensive sex education. It's really anything but comprehensive, but they call themselves comprehensive sex education. Students are taught that gender is socially constructed and that it's fluid. It says that sex is between the legs, gender is between the ears. It's all in your mind. And they do this in such a way that there's no debate whatsoever. Students are taught this as fact. And this diagram demonstrates that. This is a diagram that is used by a sex education program in California, but this is standard stuff. And you're going to find this here too, I'm sure. So there's three areas that are circled, and it's the head, the heart, and the genital area. And the diagram indicates that sex is determined by the genitals. Gender, whether you experience yourself as male or female, is determined in the mind. And the heart determines sexual orientation, who one is attracted to romantically. So the message is these are three different things, and they're not related one to the other. Now, this is from Rainbow Youth. Gender identity is a person's own sense of identification as male or female. So it's about feelings, and sex and gender are not synonyms. This way of thinking says that because gender is a feeling, it can change throughout life. A boy does not always become a man, and a girl doesn't necessarily grow into a woman. Furthermore, while sex may be either male or female, in other words, binary, either or, gender, they say, is a spectrum, a continuum. Gender is not necessarily male or female. It can be both or neither. You might feel like you weren't born with the right body, or even feel somewhere in between. Students are told that it's normal to feel in between, neither male or female, and that the traditional belief that people must fit into two rigid categories, they call that the gender binary, and they say it is false and oppressive. Now, as you are aware, nowadays the term gender is ubiquitous. It is used instead of sex on all sorts of forms. You tell me. I mean, we, on our driver's license, job, school applications, instead of sex, it says gender. Is that true here also? Okay. Why, not long ago, did a driver's license and other identifications indicate sex, but now it indicates gender? It's because our language has been quietly changed. The substitution of the term gender for sex may seem trivial, but don't be fooled. It is very significant. George Orwell wrote, "Language is an instrument that can be shaped for a specific purpose." Our thinking is affected by the words we use. What is the purpose of substituting gender for sex, and how does it affect our thinking? I submit that the purpose is social change. Advocates of this agenda fervently believe that the world will be a better place when the distinctions between male and female are blurred or even eliminated. A critical step in that direction is for male and female to be seen as subjective, not objective states. This leads us to the view that male-female differences are relative, not essential. Replacing sex with gender foists this radical agenda on us, especially on unsuspecting, impressionable young people. I can tell you from my firsthand experience as a child and adolescent psychiatrist that a price is being paid, and sometimes a very steep price, by teaching this theory called gender theory. Patients have come to me for psychiatric care who consider themselves neither male or female. I met a young woman who decided at the age of 20 that she's really a man. The thought never occurred to her until she learned about gender fluidity in her women's studies class. I also saw an 11-year-old boy who'd seen this slide. You're familiar with Oprah? Are you familiar with this individual that... Okay. So the young boy that I saw in my office was concerned because he thought that maybe he could get pregnant too. And there were adults, you should know, who were very confused about this as well. And part of it, I think, is because the media called this individual a pregnant man. And that certainly didn't help to confuse people. But even if I didn't see this evidence of confusion that male, even if I didn't see this evidence of the confusion that results from teaching that male and female are socially constructed, I would still contend that it shouldn't be taught because it's not true. It's been discredited by science. Male and female are distinct biological entities. They are objective realities, not feelings, not subjective constructs. So I'm going to examine this closely, and I'm going to look at the history of the term gender, the theory behind it, and the worldview that it promotes. My goal is to convince you that the term gender should be obsolete. Perhaps the theory has some historical significance, but aside from that, it has no place in the 21st century. Before going further, I want to get something important out of the way, and that is that there are very rare individuals who, from an early age, are convinced that they were, for lack of a better term, born in the wrong body. This condition is called gender identity disorder, GID. Children and adults who have this disorder are persistently distressed day in and day out with being male or female. The incidence is very hard to establish, but it's reasonable to call it rare. It's estimated that 1 out of 12,000 boys and 1 out of 30,000 girls have gender identity disorder. These people suffer a great deal. They need our understanding, as well as medical and psychiatric help. But I am not speaking about these people now. I'm describing an ideology that normalizes this, that says when a girl loathes her body and is saving money to pay for mastectomies, it's simply a variant of normal gender expression. This is what gender activists would like us to believe. So how did we get to this? Not long ago, the word gender was a grammatical term only. It was used to classify nouns as masculine, feminine, or neuter. For example, in French, the word book is masculine, the word table is feminine. And that was called the gender of the table, the gender of the book. Sex, on the other hand, categorized living things as male or female. So gender described nouns, sex described people. Then John Money came along. He was a psychologist, and you'll be so proud to know that he was born very nearby in Mournsville. Dr. John Money. Dr. Money was fascinated by hermaphrodism, which is a rare medical disorder in which both male and female organs are found. At the birth of one of these unfortunate children, there are urgent questions. Is this a boy or a girl? Do we use a blue blanket or a pink blanket? What about a name? And what should family and friends be told? John Money pioneered the work in sex assignment, which was the complex decision of whether to raise a particular child with hermaphrodism as male or female. He was certain, and this goes back now to the 60s when he was working, he was certain that aside from anatomy, the differences between men and women are culturally determined. And this is what he wrote. Men impregnate. Women menstruate, ovulate, gestate, and lactate. All other distinctions are due to socialization. John Money introduced the concept that babies are born gender neutral and that over time they develop an internal sense of being male or female, separate from their chromosomes or anatomy. He borrowed the grammatical term gender to describe this inner experience. And he argued that psychologically, all of us, we are all hermaphrodites on a psychological level, meaning we are born with the potential of identifying as male or female, regardless of our genitalia or chromosomes. So a baby girl, let's call her Jill, with two X chromosomes, she has the potential of feeling like a boy because she's born gender neutral. She could potentially feel like either Jill or Jack. Baby Jack, he has a penis, but if he's dressed in pink and he's given dolls and surgery and estrogen, he'll do fine as Jill. According to this scheme, Jack and Jill's futures depend on messages they'll receive in the first years of life from their environment, from family, friends, school, church, and the media. And John Money's life was dedicated to promoting his theory that psychologically we are all hermaphrodites. All this was just speculation on his part until a family with a unique dilemma arrived in his office. The incredible story that I'm about to tell you is documented in the book As Nature Made Him, The Boy Who Was Raised as a Girl. This is required reading if you're interested in this subject. The book is actually out of print, but if you go onto Amazon or other book-selling sites, you can find, you know, used copies that are available. You will not be able to put this book down. So this is the story. In the late 60s, a young Canadian couple by the name of Reamer gave birth to identical twin boys. They named them Bruce and Brian. These boys were 100% fine at birth, but during Bruce's circumcision at 8 months of age, something went terribly wrong, and his penis was essentially burned beyond repair. The Reamers were desperate for months until they heard Dr. Money on television explaining that gender identity is not inborn, it's learned, and how, therefore, a boy could be successfully raised as a girl. The Reamers turned to Dr. Money for guidance, and when Bruce was 22 months old, he was castrated, renamed Brenda, and dressed in pink. Dr. Money warned the Reamers that they were not under any condition to tell Brenda that she'd been born a boy. So she was raised with dolls and dresses alongside Brian, who was given trucks and G.I. Joes. And there you see Brenda sitting down and Brian standing up. This was the perfect test case for John Money, because Brian was the quintessential matched control. He was a genetic clone of Brenda's. So with this case, he could prove to the world that gender is determined by environment, not biology, that maleness and femaleness is all in the mind, and that psychologically, we are all hermaphrodites. John Money followed the twins for about 10 years, and he declared the experiment a complete success. Brenda Reamer became Dr. Money's most famous patient. He used a different name, obviously. The landmark case was held up as proof of his theory, and Dr. Money's ideas were accepted and taught as dogma. Parents all over the world that were facing similar circumstances due to their son's trauma or a medical condition were advised to castrate them and raise them as girls. Fast forward to 1997. Brenda came forward, but she wasn't Brenda anymore. She was now David, a janitor in a slaughterhouse, married, and father to 3 adopted children. The whole thing was a hoax. The experiment had been a complete failure. Far from accepting his gender reassignment, David had fought against it tooth and nail from the very beginning. He refused to play with dolls, he ripped his dresses off, he preferred wrestling over cooking, and he even, whenever possible, would urinate standing up. Brenda had been teased relentlessly for the boyish way she moved, spoke, and gestured. Kids called her cave woman. In second grade, she wanted to be a garbage man. And in eighth, she wanted to be an auto mechanic. After years of this nightmare, not only for Brenda, but for the whole family, Brenda's psychiatrist urged her parents to reveal the truth. Brenda actually was suicidal. She was so confused, so desperate, and her psychiatrist told the parents to tell her, despite John Money's warning never to do so, and the parents gave in. The twins were 14 when Brenda was told she'd been born a boy. Speaking about that moment years later, David said, "I was relieved. Suddenly, it all made sense why I felt the way I did. I wasn't some sort of weirdo. I wasn't crazy." And this is David when he got older. He picked the name David instead of going back to Bruce, because he felt like David fighting Goliath. He felt like that's what his life was like. So he picked the name David. So it sounds like sort of a happy ending, but it wasn't. Unimaginable damage had been inflicted on this family, and both David and his twin were eventually lost to suicide. Brian from an overdose at age 36, and David from suicide at age 38. You might think that when this fiasco came to light, that clinicians and social scientists would re-examine, if not completely reject, John Money's gender theory that was based on this case. I regret to say that hasn't happened. Instead, it's David's story that's been rejected. It's been completely ignored. On sites recommended to young people by organizations like Family Planning and Rainbow Youth, there is no mention of this disastrous experiment. Instead, John Money's gender theory is presented as fact. Maleness and femaleness, young people are told, are feelings. They are inner experiences. They are separate from sex. In the 60s, Money's theory may have been plausible given what was known at the time, but in this century, it's not. 50 years ago, it was thought that the Y chromosome carried little important information. Remember, females have two X chromosomes, males have an X and a Y. So it was thought 50 years ago that that Y chromosome, it was called a genetic wasteland. That being the case, it could have been reasonably argued that if men and women have essentially the same genetic endowment, if that Y chromosome can just be dismissed, then you could argue that the differences are from socialization. But that was before the biotech revolution. And now, this is a photo of the X and Y chromosome. We can scrutinize chromosomes. We can map them out. We have mapped them out. And we know that the Y chromosome, which is the one on the right there, is teeming with DNA that is unique to males. And this is just, I know you can't read it, but it's a map of all the various genes that are on the Y chromosome. So the Y chromosome is filled with important information that is unique to males. It's not a genetic wasteland. So there are distinct male and female blueprints that are created at the moment of conception. I love that picture. So at that very moment is determined what the chromosomal makeup will be of the fetus, and it is either male or female. This is a biological truth. Neurobiologists acknowledge that from before birth, there is a male brain and a female brain. The prenatal brain develops in a female direction unless instructed otherwise. So the default brain type is the female type. But in a male fetus, a gene on the Y chromosome instructs the testicles to produce and secrete testosterone, and that changes everything. Testosterone prevents the development of a feminine brain, and by that I mean one that has larger centers for communication. You know, we like to talk a lot. And emotional memory. You know, we remember every little fight. And the testosterone establishes a masculine course for the brain, which means there's more brain space devoted to centers for action, aggression, and sex drive. The cascade of testosterone's effects are global and permanent. Although some manifestations aren't seen for years, such as the changes of puberty, the boy brain trajectory is set at 8 weeks, not 8 weeks after birth, 8 weeks after conception. Right here. The fetus has either a boy brain or a girl brain before some women even know they're pregnant. The research supporting this fact is voluminous. This is something that's not up for debate, but of course, to groups like Family Planning and the others, it doesn't exist. Now, I want to share with you some more of the science, and keep in mind, I am not speaking of every single boy and girl. I am speaking of most boys and most girls. There are always the exception, but it is fair to talk about most boys or most girls. So here we go. This is just the tip of the iceberg. At 1 day of age, boys will look longer at a mobile, while girls are more interested in a smiling face. Presumably, one day is too early to have been taught by your environment, you know, who you are. At a year of age, girls' attention is drawn to a video of a face moving, whereas boys prefer a video of cars moving. Right? Don't you? And at both 1 and 2 years of age, girls make more eye contact with their mothers than boys do, and the amount of eye contact is inversely correlated with the amount of testosterone they had intrauterine. In other words, girls make testosterone too, much less, but when a girl has more testosterone during the 9 months in uterus, that's correlated with less of the eye contact. It is universally accepted that chromosomes and prenatal hormones predispose boys and girls to have specific toy preferences, styles of playing and interacting, and many, many other qualities and behaviors. And in fact, this is true in juvenile monkeys also. These juvenile monkeys were given a choice of toys. On the left side, you see a female who has picked the doll. And on the right, you see the boy playing with the police car. So I suppose we have gender stereotypes in the jungle, too. Students and parents never hear about all of this. It's as if we're still in the middle of the last century. This is from a pamphlet for parents from Family Planning, explaining that children pick up on this. These messages from society at a young age, and that it's due to the way that you might role modeling as a parent and what you do at home and the comments you make, etc. But there's no mention of the science that we currently know. Science in the 21st century has discredited Dr. Money's theory. It's in fact blown it out of the water. Science in this century supports that bipolar gender system that students are urged to reject. And I want to mention something else. There's a serious lapse in intellectual honesty. When sex educators claim to celebrate diversity, to accept everyone for who they are, and this is the logo of Rainbow Youth, and you'll note it says, "Know who you are, be who you are." But there's one group that doesn't extend to. That doesn't extend to people who are attracted to the same sex, but they are unhappy with it. They want to struggle against it. They feel it's not who they really are. But these same people who have as their logo, "Know who you are, be who you are," they would argue that such a person really is gay, but they can't accept it. Because this person has been has bought into society's homophobia. So let's say if there's a woman who at the age of 20 feels her real identity is male, we're not supposed to question that because only she knows who she is. If she demands hormone injections and irreversible surgery and she wants her birth certificate legally changed so it says male, she has the right to do all that. And her journey should be celebrated. But if a 20-year-old woman is troubled by her attraction to other women, well, she has a problem. Clearly, this woman can't accept who she really is. She doesn't know who she is, but we do. This is an astonishing lack of intellectual integrity. So, to summarize, an ideology has been foisted on us that blurs the distinctions between male and female. But neurobiology in this millennium highlights those distinctions, and it's adding to their numbers so often that it's hard to keep current in this exploding field. What is the significance of this in the debate about marriage? I think it's straightforward. Put aside for a moment the legal arguments and put aside how the children turn out. By the way, there is new research that has come out just in the past month or so studying the children of couples, same-sex couples, but basically this debate over marriage boils down to the definition of a word. If John Money's theory is valid, if maleness and femaleness are subjective and they can change and they're fluid and it's just between the ears, you can't argue that marriage is only between a man and a woman, because the very notion of man and woman as two distinct entities is made up, is fiction. But John Money's theory is phony. Phony. You use that word, right? Hard science indicates that we are not psychological hermaphrodites. Our biology dictates our maleness and our femaleness. Biology indicates there is a bipolar system. It's not an oppressive paradigm. It is an objective truth. It follows then that the union of male and female, emotionally, physically, and spiritually, is a distinct reality. These are some of the reasons why the term gender, aside from its grammatical use, should be obsolete. The story of David Reamer is, among other things, a tale of one doctor's arrogance and readiness to sacrifice a family to promote himself and his ideas. That same arrogance is seen now among those who force-feed young people last century's social agendas. And they withhold the biological truths that blow those agendas out of the water. So to finish, this is a war of ideas. It's certainly an uphill battle, but the battles worth fighting are always uphill. I hope that the information I've presented here will be powerful ammunition for you as you return to the battlefield. Thank you. Oh, wait. Okay, this is also part of the story here. From the Education Gazette, Ministry of Education, 21st of May, 2012. There's an article here about rainbow youth coming into the schools. And they claim to be coming into the schools because they want to make the schools safe for everybody. And this is part of the manipulation that's used. Because if you're against that, that means you're against making schools safe. So it's this is what liberals do. They base their arguments on emotion, and then they demonize us for being against these wonderful ideas and the ideal world that they want to create. They make us feel guilty because we don't have compassion for people. Now, it's very hard to have a civil debate with these people because they immediately charge us with being hateful, and they just call us names. They don't address the facts, just like I have not been able to debate anyone while I'm here. But I just wanted to point out to you that someone from Family Youth, who's in charge of the programs for putting into schools, they say here, describing the material that they have, that it enables dominant ideas to be destabilized. And this is their choice of word. You always have to do this. Look at the words your opponent is using. Dominant ideas to be destabilized. Teaching within a framework of critical thinking means learners can use this technique of questioning dominance. And what that means is questioning what you hear at home, questioning what you hear in church, etc. And she says, the feedback is generally pretty positive from her programs in the schools. There are times when people's beliefs are challenged. Sometimes, listen closely, sometimes we can't go as far as we'd like to. But we do our best. So what they're actually doing is not, what you're seeing them do now in the schools is not really what they would like to do. There's a lot more. First, you desensitize. It's a process. People are shocked at this at first. But the way we're made, human nature is such that the more often you see something shocking or hear something shocking, you get used to it. And after a while, it's not that shocking. So it's this, they use this process of slowly but surely exposing us to what their agenda really is. So you need to beware of that. And one last thing I want to say in general with liberals is that, you see, we believe that they're wrong, but they believe that we're evil. And there's a big difference there. Okay, we're evil because we're standing in the way of their utopia, of a world, you know, where everyone can be who they are, quote unquote. Their certain vision of how they think the world should be. We want to use facts to debate them, but they operate with feelings. And so you need to know that that's how they operate. And if you base yourself in these facts and you don't get sucked into the emotional arguments that they're making, you can have a lot of success. Okay, I'm done.